Welcome to another AAT podcast. Today, providing an update on some UK residence and domicile issues, where there have been a number of changes in recent years. Significant changes were introduced by Finance Act 2008, becoming effective from the 6th of April 2008. A summary of the Finance Act 2008 changes to the residence domicile rules is as follows. Most individuals who are entitled to use the remittance basis of taxation now need to make an annual claim before they can do so. Individuals claiming the remittance basis of taxation, where they have unremitted foreign income or gains of £2,000 or more arising in the tax year, will lose their entitlement to personal tax allowances and the annual exempt amount for capital gains tax. The introduction of an annual £30,000 tax charge for adult remittance basis users resident in the UK in the current year and for seven or more of the previous nine tax years, where they have unremitted foreign income or gains of £2,000 or more in the current year. Changing the day counting rules that determine when someone becomes resident in the UK under the 183-day rule to count as a day, any day upon which an individual is in the UK at the end of that day. In other words, at midnight, but subject to a new rule for transit passengers. The closure of a number of loopholes and flaws in the remittance basis that allowed people to bring untaxed income or gains into the UK tax-free. Subsequently, HMRC has issued new guidance, firstly replacing its booklet IR20, Residents and Non-Residents, Liability to Tax in the UK, with the new booklet HMRC6, Residents, Domicile and the Remittance Basis Guidance. That guidance is mainly aimed at individuals and is considered by many to be an unfinished piece of work. There is more guidance in the Employment Income Manual from EIM 42800, and more information can be found on the HMRC website at www.hmrc.gov.uk/CNR/RES-DOM-Tax-Amends. This will open up a lot of guidance, including the following. A simple guide to residence, ordinary residence and domicile. Revised guidance on letting property. A short guide for international students on what they need to know about UK tax. The residence domicile and the remittance basis guidance, HMRC 6. Technical guidance on the remittance basis is found within the residence domicile and remittances manual, RDRM. And more detailed guidance on domicile is also found there. Guidance on capital gains tax Finance Act 2008 changes affecting beneficiaries of non-resident settlements, the October 2009 version. New guidance on the application of the remittance basis to the transfer of assets. Updates to the capital gains tax manual to reflect the remittance basis changes. Section 690 ITPA directions guidance. Updated guidance on employment-related securities and the remittance basis. Guidance on coming to work in the UK. A statement of practice 1/09, which replaced 5/1984. And those frequently asked questions that have yet to be incorporated into the new guidance. So you can see there's quite a lot of guidance on the website. UK income tax is charged mainly on the basis of tax residence and to a lesser extent, domicile. The basic principle is that an individual may be charged UK tax on his worldwide income if he is resident in the UK, and even where he is not resident in the UK, he will still be liable to pay tax on income that arises or is earned in the UK. An individual can be tax resident in the UK while still being tax resident in another country at the same time. For example, the UK and the USA, or the UK and France. The UK has entered into many double taxation agreements with other countries, with a view to avoiding UK nationals being taxed twice on the same earnings. And of course, these agreements provide similar protection for employees coming to the UK, and indeed the agreements cover a lot more than earnings. The conditions to be met before tax relief is given under a double taxation agreement for earnings are: the employee must not be in the UK for more than 183 days in the specified period, which may be a tax year but is often a 12-month period. Secondly, the remuneration must be paid by or on behalf of an employee who is not resident in the UK. And thirdly, it must not be borne by a UK branch of the employer. The UK has a tax year that runs from the 6th of April in one year to the 5th of April in the following year. But other countries normally have a tax year that is the calendar year, running from 1st of January to the 31st of December. This means that extra care is required in keeping records of the days spent working in the UK and elsewhere to minimise any potential tax liabilities. Prior to the 6th of April 2008, a non-UK resident employee would not normally have been liable to tax on income that had arisen or was earned overseas. Up to 5th of April 2008, anyone who had not been ordinarily resident and or domiciled in the UK was able to shelter any non-UK income from a UK income tax charge, except that is for any income that was actually remitted or brought into the UK. The remittance basis changes that I've already mentioned now mean that advisors to individuals affected by these changes have to consider the impact of the rules on a yearly basis, deciding whether or not to adopt the remittance basis for any particular tax year. HMRC guidance states that there are many different factors which will determine whether you are resident in the UK during a tax year. It goes on to say that with one exception, it is not simply a question of the number of days you are physically present in the UK during a tax year, although this is an important consideration. Where someone is physically present in the UK for 183 days or more during a tax year, they will be UK tax resident in that tax year. And as the HMRC guidance tells us, there are no exceptions to this. When counting the number of days of presence in the UK during a tax year, we have to include all of the days in which the employee has been in the UK at midnight at the end of the day. Just an example here, Manuel from Madrid was seconded to work in the UK for 2 years from the 1st of April 2009. And he travels to London every Monday morning, returning home on Friday afternoon. He is regarded as being physically present in the UK on 4 nights per week, Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night and Thursday night, and therefore his total UK days would amount to, say, 188 days over 47 weeks if we allow for 5 weeks holiday. This would establish his UK tax residence. Manuel may choose to manage his UK visits to avoid spending 183 days here, but he will need to keep appropriate records to prove that to the UK authorities. A passenger travelling between two foreign countries via the UK may not have to count the day of arrival in the UK for UK tax resident purposes, even if they remain here at midnight on that day. This exemption is only for passengers in transit, and will only apply if their activities while in the UK are substantially related to completing travel to a foreign destination. HMRC guidance says that if you attend a business meeting, visit a property you own, arrange to meet people socially or attend social activities, you must count that day as a day of presence if you're in the UK at the end of the day. It sounds to me like you have to stay in the hotel room, drinking on your own and watching television. The strict position is that an individual is taxed as a UK resident for the whole of any tax year when they are tax resident in the UK for any part of the year. However, if someone leaves or comes to the UK partway through a tax year, then by concession, HMRC allows the tax year to be split, limiting the UK tax liability to the part of the year when the individual is actually in the UK. This allows for splitting the years into resident and non-resident periods. The split treatment will apply to individuals who come to the UK to take up permanent residence or to stay for at least 2 years, or to individuals who leave the UK to become permanently resident abroad, or leave the UK for full-time service under a contract of employment. Next, I want to discuss ordinary residence, which is different from tax resident status, established by spending 183 days or more in the UK. Ordinary tax residence indicates a longer-term stay, although it does not require the intention to remain permanently or indefinitely in the UK. The new HMRC guidance states that it is enough that your residence has all the following attributes. You have come to the UK voluntarily. The fact that you choose to come to the UK at the request of your employer rather than seek another job does not make your presence here involuntary. Your presence has a settled purpose. This might be for only a limited period, but has enough continuity to be properly described as settled. Business, employment, and family all provide a settled purpose, but this list is not exhaustive. Your presence in the UK forms part of the regular and habitual mode of your life for the time being. This pattern can include temporary absences from the UK. If you come to live and work in the UK for 3 years or more, then you will have established a regular and habitual mode of life here. HMRC will treat an employer that comes to the UK to work and live for 3 years or more as ordinary resident in the UK. HMRC also states that the owning or acquisition of accommodation on a long-term lease may be taken as evidence of the intention to remain in the UK for several years, and the individual will be treated as ordinary resident from the date of arrival. This could be a problem for someone coming to the UK for a short time who decides to invest in UK property when perhaps they consider prices to be low. The UK has a tax residence rule that is almost unique, and it looks at the average number of days spent in the UK over a period of time. Ordinary residence is normally established where an employee spends an average of over 90 days in a 4-year period, becoming ordinary resident from the start of the fifth tax year. As an example, Patrick comes to work in the UK from time to time, and over the past 4 tax years, his aggregate days spent in the UK have been 85 days in 2006-07, 105 days in 2007-08, 90 days in 2008-09, and 93 days in 2009-10, given an average of more than 90 days, and therefore he would be regarded as tax resident. The latest guidance, HMRC 6 from HMRC, gives us an example where ordinary tax residence was established in the fourth year, not in the fifth year. That is of some concern to many people. Next section, domicile. There is no statutory definition of domicile, although the coalition government intends to review the current rules. HMRC's guidance tells us that domicile is a general law concept, distinct from nationality or residence, and that broadly speaking, you are domiciled in the country where you have your permanent home. HMRC has always insisted that domicile is only relevant for tax purposes if someone wishes to claim the remittance basis. But as I always point out on my training courses, domicile is also relevant for certain travel expenses that can be claimed by non-UK domiciled employees working in the UK. An individual is normally domiciled in the country or state of their permanent home, and everyone must have a place of domicile, which for most people is normally their place of birth. It may therefore be different from where they live or work. Another example. Barry was born in Barnet and moved to Belgium, where he has worked for the last 10 years. He's recently been seconded to Israel, where he will work for just 9 months. Barry is UK domiciled because that's where he was born and brought up. He is ordinary resident in Belgium because he's been there for 10 years, and he will become a short-term tax resident of Israel, because he'll be there for more than 183 days. Next, I want to look at the domicile of origin, which people normally acquire at birth. It will normally be the domicile of the child's father at the time when the baby is born. Where a child is born in a country that is different from the domicile of the father, the child will normally take the domicile of the father. So Barry, for example, where the child was probably born in Belgium, the child would still be regarded as UK domicile. Where a child's mother is not married or is legally separated, any children she has will be domiciled in her country of domicile. Next, we have the domicile of dependence, which would apply to any children who are not old enough to choose their domicile, and it could apply to a married woman who adopts her husband's domicile if the husband's domicile is different from his wife's at the time of the marriage. Finally, and what can be more problematical, is the domicile of choice. Unlike tax residents, we can only have one domicile at any time, but this may change if an individual makes that decision to change the domicile. However, the individual will have to satisfy HMRC that the change has taken place. HMRC guidance states that you have the legal capacity to acquire a new domicile at age 16, and it tells us that to make that change, you must leave the existing country of domicile and settle in another country. Anyone doing this may need to prove strong evidence of the intention to live there permanently or indefinitely. Living in another country for a long time, although an important factor, may not be accepted as sufficient proof. For example, John, who moved to Australia at age 17, settled there, married an Australian, and together they have children. HMRC would undoubtedly accept that someone in these circumstances has chosen and established a new life and a new domicile in Australia. There has always been a great reluctance on the part of HMRC and indeed the Old Inland Revenue to give a domicile ruling. And its stated position is that it will only consider the question of domicile if it is immediately relevant in deciding the income tax liability or capital gains tax liability. HMRC has now withdrawn the form DOM 1 that was previously used to make an application for a ruling. In my view, domicile is relevant at other times when non-domiciled people come into the UK are able to claim additional tax relief for travelling expenses. Section 4, come into work in the UK. Next, I want to look at the income tax treatment of employees coming to work in the UK from overseas, and the changes that have taken place in relation to the forms that have to be completed. Their treatment will depend on the time spent in the UK, and the intentions of the employee may also be relevant. If the employee is coming from abroad to live and work permanently, or indefinitely, he or she will be resident and ordinarily resident from the date of arrival. If an employee from abroad is assigned for a period of 3 years or more, HMRC will treat them as resident and ordinary resident from the date of arrival. An employee coming from abroad will not be able to provide a P45 to the employer. The P46 procedure should be applied to decide whether to apply the emergency tax code, code 647L, on either a cumulative or a non-cumulative basis, or whether code basic rate has to be applied if statement C is signed or no statement is signed by the employee. HMRC previously required employees to complete Form P86 for employees arriving in the UK for the first time, or coming back to the UK after a period of absence. But that form has now been withdrawn. AAT members may still consider using the form to obtain the relevant information from a new client who has come from abroad, but you will not need to submit the completed form to HMRC. Most of its questions are factual, such as the date of arrival in the UK, and the reason for coming to the UK. It is important at the outset to establish how long the employee intends to stay in the UK and that the intention does not conflict with the period of assignment. I will always insist on seeing a copy of the assignment letter. I've mentioned Form P46, but we now have a new form, P46 Expat, that was introduced on the 6th of April 2009. This has effectively replaced the form P86, which was withdrawn. A seconded employee includes individuals working wholly or partly in the UK for a UK resident employer on assignment whilst remaining employed by an overseas employer. It includes individuals assigned to work wholly or partly in the UK at a recognised branch of their overseas employer's business. It includes all individuals included by an employer within a dedicated expatriate scheme, and all individuals included by an employer within an expatriate modified pay-as-you-earn scheme. It is a two-part form, with Section 1 to be completed by the employee, who has to provide factual information on name, address, national insurance number, date of birth and gender, and completing one of the following statements, which are slightly different to the normal P46. Statement A says, I intend to live in the UK for more than 6 months. Or Statement B says, I intend to live in the UK for less than 6 months. Or Statement C says, I will be working for the employer both inside and outside the UK, but will be living abroad. There is a Statement D, which is used in the UK except for Scotland, and it's the student loan question. Section 2 of the form is to be completed by the employer, again providing factual information and finishing with a decision to be made on which tax code to be used. Emergency code 647L cumulative will apply if the employee is an EEA or Commonwealth citizen, or if Statement A has been completed. Otherwise, emergency code on a non-cumulative basis will apply. It should be remembered that employers with more than 50 employees are required to file starter and leaver forms, including the P46 expat, through the online system, and that from 6 of April 2011, all employees, with very few exceptions, will be required to file these forms online. Next section, Section 5, UK employees going to work overseas. Many UK employees will undertake short-term business trips overseas, but they will remain UK tax resident and pay income tax and national insurance contributions in the normal way. They may become tax resident in the country that they visit if they spend an aggregate of 183 days there, and we may have to consider the relevance of any double tax agreement. Where regular overseas business trips are made, records should be kept to monitor the number of days in aggregate in the tax year, probably a calendar year of the country or countries being visited. If the aggregate number of days does not exceed 183, the employee should remain on the UK payroll and be taxed in the UK in the normal way. No income tax liability should arise in the host country. If an overseas secondment or the aggregate number of days abroad for various business trips exceeds 183 days but does not exceed 12 months, the employee will continue to be resident and ordinarily resident in the UK and will continue to pay UK taxes in the normal way, although there may be a liability in the host country visited as well. Advice may need to be obtained from advisors in the overseas jurisdiction as to what host liability exists and how this should be dealt with, but UK income tax deductions will continue in the normal way. An example, Gavin and his family live in Barry, South Wales, and he's sent by his UK employer to work in Belgium for 18 months, working there for more than a whole tax year, but less than 2 years. Gavin acquires Belgian tax residence and becomes non-UK resident, but he retains his ordinary tax resident status in the UK. Unless and until it is decided that he should remain in Belgium for more than 2 years, Gavin's tax status would not be affected by his home and family continuing to be in Wales. A UK employee, like Gavin, will be able to become non-resident in the UK provided that they are posted on a full-time secondment abroad for a period that includes a complete UK tax year, and they spend less than 183 days in the UK on return visits. And if the secondment goes over a number of years, they must not spend an average of more than 90 days a year over a four-year period. The timing of the posting and dates of return may also be crucial. If an employee, for example, were posted overseas for 12 months on the 1st of April at the start of a new financial year and returns 12 months later at the end of March, that employee would not have been outside the UK for a full UK tax year and would continue to have been liable to UK taxes in the normal way. Ideally, the posting would be, say, from the 1st of April in the first year to the 30th of April, or at least a date after the 5th of April in the following tax year. The employee would then have been outside of the UK for a full 12-month period. The employee would need to be advised of the importance of these dates and of the need to keep proper records. The UK employee will have to operate pay as you earn using the current tax code at least up to the date of departure, and should apply for a no tax code to be able to stop UK tax deductions from the date of departure. That needs to be done as early as possible, as there is often a backlog of such applications. The UK employer must not overlook that PAYE and Class 1 NICs may still have to be deducted from payments of bonuses or share-based incentives after the employee has left the UK. This will apply if the bonuses or share incentives relate to duties performed before they left the UK. The employee leaving the UK and becoming non-resident will need to complete a Form P85 to claim a repayment of any overpaid tax. Form P85 S for Sugar has to be used for non-UK citizens who may perhaps be returning home at the end of an assignment. 6. Summary. Residence and domicile is a difficult subject, and where AAT members and perhaps their employers or their employer clients have UK employees who are sent abroad or have employees who come from abroad to work, careful consideration is needed of the income tax treatment for the employees as individuals and in relation to the employer's responsibility to operate PAYE. I have always said that it is easier to deal with the situation of employees that are posted overseas because they should already be on the books, including the payroll, and we are aware of them, and we have time to plan, or should have time to plan, what is required in terms of continuing or stopping PAYE and NIC deductions. Employees coming from abroad can be more problematical, especially if they start working in the UK without any consideration being given to their tax treatment. This might be perhaps because it starts with short business trips that can be ignored, but then this increases and UK tax residence becomes established by spending more than 183 days in the UK or more than 90 days a year average over 4 years. I must emphasise the importance of keeping records of the assignment and for counting the number of days spent in the UK to determine whether UK tax residence is established. Similarly, for UK employees posted abroad, there will be the requirements to obtain advice, keep records, to determine whether overseas liabilities arise, and perhaps professional advice from overseas will need to be taken. Thank you for listening to me today. I hope that my comments were helpful to you.